Oh, hey, how are you?
Great to hear.
Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable.
Like a drink?
Sure.
There you go.
Welcome to the Tech Lounge.
Shall we begin?
Welcome to the Tech Lounge with me, Christian Schiller. I have a wonderful guest in the Tech Lounge today, and that is Daniel Temkin, who, well, he does all sorts of things. I think that's the best way of describing him. I saw him speaking at FOSDEM in Brussels back in February, and probably in a very FOSDEM talk, a very strange esoteric talk, which is interesting because that's exactly what we speak about on this episode. His book that is now out as of a couple of weeks, which is all about esoteric programming languages, these sort of artistic projects of a programming language that maybe don't have any real purpose, but just to have some fun, to explore, to do something weird, which I feel like is something that's missing a little bit sometimes in modern computing and on the modern internet. This interview actually also provided a lot of the content for an article I wrote for IEEE Spectrum, also on Daniel's book. So I'll put a link in the notes for that article too. There was a little bit of odd background noise in the first half of the interview that I had to apply a fair bit of processing to get rid of, but do pursue it because it's a really... I know I say this a lot, but it's a really interesting conversation and quite fascinating and a perfect guest for the Tech Lounge. Enjoy. Manning are perhaps one of the best known tech book publishers in the industry. I have featured some of their authors on my podcast quite a few times. I've even done technical reviews of a few of their books. Maybe one day I'll even get around to actually writing a book for them. But in the meantime, I have a link for you that will get you 35% off of anything on the Manning website, anything. All you have to do is head on over to go.christianschiller.com/Manning and enjoy learning something new. Doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Now, I wanted to speak to you. There's this wonderful event that I know a lot of people in Europe know. I don't know how many outside of Europe, called FOSDEM. And FOSDEM is many things, but it's often these wonderful talks where you just see someone talking about something really strange, really passionately. And I said to a friend of mine I was with this year, I just saw the most FOSDEM talk ever. And I can't remember exactly what it was now, but I think you were covering a programming language that used Greek alphabet. Is that about right?
That's right. So yeah. Using the Greek alphabet shouldn't sound that strange at first, because we have the example of PPL and, you know, it's used in mathematics. I wanted to use a very small alphabet, and an alphabet that would be both sort of unfamiliar, but one that didn't have like a strong association to people for people already. So I decided to use the sort of weights and measures symbols from ancient Greek. So the good thing about this language, it's called valence, needed eight signs for it. The idea of the language was, it's sort of an experiment in bringing some aspects of natural language into code, which a lot of my languages do. And in this case, it was about creating a sort of syntactic ambiguity. So just as you could, you know, create an English sentence like, you know, Bob saw the group with the telescope, and you can't quite be sure of whether it's Bob who has the telescope and he's seeing the group through it, or if it's the group that has the telescope. It's like, what if we wrote code that way? Mm. So you write something, and now you have two programs. It creates two different programs, one where Bob has the telescope and one where the group has the telescope. So in valence, you write code in a way that has this, both an ambiguity of the sign itself and a syntactic structure of the sentence. Mm-hmm. And every time you introduce something that has ambiguity, it just splits the program. And now you have two running side by side. Now you use a different combination of symbols that's also the interpreter doesn't understand. So it splits those two into four or six. And depending on how you write your code, you could end up with one program. you know, where you've sort of ironed out all the ambiguity, or you could have, you know, hundreds running side by side. But it's really about sort of experimenting in that semantic space.
And it was reminded me, because this is, I think, is a fairly famous example in this kind of group of languages, which we're going to talk about in this interview. I was back in Melbourne last June and I saw a talk on Brainfuck, and the guy did a demo of Hello World, and it took pages of code and about 5 minutes to compile. And it was, again, one of these talks where you're kind of like, this is amazing. But I suppose the question you get asked a lot is probably, why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. So I think of it the same way as any art project. It's like, there's an idea I want to explore. Mm. It has to do with natural language and code. I make a language that explores it in one way, and that sort of raises new questions that then I explore in the next language that I make. So much of the recent work that I've done in esoteric languages is around sort of a mix of natural language and code. Mm. Probably in some ways a reaction to its use in AI to find other ways of pairing these things.
I think I feel like that was something I marked in somewhere. So the reason we're talking is not just because of that talk, but you actually have a book coming out, which we will dig into a little bit more. But I think one of the passages I highlighted was around this, you know, a language that an AI can't really understand because it doesn't really make sense. Which was kind of interesting statement in itself. It's like intentionally trying to confuse the machine by doing something so illogical. A logical thing can't understand it.
Yeah, there are a lot of what I'm exploring in the book is sort of what's our default way of understanding our relationship with the machine when we write code, and different ways to sort of complicate that or sort of dig deeper into that relationship.
To complicate. I like the fact you say to complicate it. That's because the general computing industry at least alludes to wanting to make things easier. Even though that might always be true, that's what it alludes to anyway.
Yes. And I think that I come back a lot to an essay by Joseph Weizenbaum, the creator of the Eliza chatbot, where he wrote about compulsiveness in code. And he had this idea of who he described as the computer bum, who's the person who is writing code and becomes really obsessed with getting everything quite right. And it doesn't work the way that he wants, or he sort of complicates it. And then when he gets it to work the way that he wants, there's more that I have to expand to make this bigger. And like, kind of the frustration of this programmer is that the computer is under their control. It's doing what they're telling it to do, but it's not doing what they actually want it to do, right? And that's sort of the classic bind in programming.
Yeah.
And so there's this idea that we command the machine when we're writing code, but how much control do we really have over what happens? I think that we're sort of all used to the idea that much of what's out there in terms of code is broken in some way, that we're sort of used to the idea of systems being sort of only somewhat.
They become incredibly complicated as well. I think this is the thing, like often these days, things will go very not according to plan because there's so many moving parts. It's very hard to track down what it is. Whereas many of the examples that you've discussed in this book are wonderfully simple. They don't always make sense, but there's no complex web of dependencies or things like this. They kind of exist in their isolation in a sort of beautiful sandbox, shall we say. Is that fair, I guess? I don't know.
Yes. Yeah, certainly. I guess one example, when we're talking about sort of the complicating our relationship with the machine or how much we're in control, is really my language Olympus. Mm. Where code is written as sort of pleas to different Greek gods. And so the basic idea of the language, so you write it in this sort of pseudo-natural language style, where you're asking various Greek gods to construct code the way you want it to be. So the code, it's almost like there's sort of a layer behind the code, which is the actual code. You're not actually sort of writing the code, you're writing pleas to create that code. And you have to ask them nicely. You know, if you call Zeus father of the gods, you can't call him that again immediately after because he doesn't think you're trying very hard. So you have to you know, he's the master of thunder, and, you know, he has all these sort of, you know, he's the god of the traveler far from home. So you kind of have to find the right sort of context in order to sort of appeal to him. But then also you can't sort of demand too much of him, especially back to back. So you have to sort of organize your code in terms of like not too much Zeus right at the beginning. You know, it's like Athena can do a lot of the things that Zeus can do. So it's sort of like, we'll do Zeus and then Athena, and then we'll go to sort of Demeter to deal with, you know, Demeter is in charge of the cycles of nature and in terms of programs and in terms of looping structures. Maybe we'll apply to Demeter here. But what's actually happening is you're building the program sort of piece by piece and not in the order that it's going to actually run. It's like you can create a function and then you can add to that function much later in the program. So you're sort of describing everything out of order and kind of skipping about this kind of surface of code in order to write this. And then, of course, if you want to end a block of code, you have to call on Hades to collect the souls of all the unused variables and so on. So it's one of the more kind of ridiculous languages, and it's the one that's sort of more fun.
Yeah.
Although what's sort of interesting about that language is that pretty much everyone's code in the end sort of looks very much the same. There's not like a lot, like, you know, the code that you write in Olympus is going to look very much like the code that I write in Olympus. So it doesn't have the same level of experimentation that you might have in, like you brought up the example of Brainfuck.
Mm.
One of the reasons that Brainfuck has been so interesting, you know, 30 years later, is that so many people have sort of discovered their own algorithms within it, their own ways of managing to kind of make new constructions of Brainfuck and find new things that you can do with Brainfuck. So it's sort of like the rules of the language are so simple that it allows many people to come in and find their own sort of things that they can sort of discover about it.
So let's, we've kind of been talking about some specific examples here, but maybe we should zoom out to a kind of, I don't know, what we're talking about is so sort of esoteric and interesting, it's easy to lose track of giving people a bit of an overview. So we're talking about esoteric languages. Is this your name for it, or is this a general name for these kind of languages?
Yeah, no, the name long predates me.
Okay.
It's so the time that ESLangs, esoteric languages, really sort of, I say sort of the modern era of ESL, well, that's not a good way of putting it. I'll say that bit again.
The contemporary era, I don't know.
you know, theoretical languages that can't be run on a computer, or experimental languages that don't have a lot of practical value, you know, that's been part of academia for as long as computer science has existed, and really sort of before that as well in math. But what we think of as ESLangs really sort of began to take off. I refuse, like, I don't want to say it took off in the early 90s because it really took off very slowly. But in 1993, there was a language called False, which was written by Wouter von Oertmersen. And the idea of False is that it's a Turing-complete language, which means theoretically you could write any algorithm that you could construct in a language like C++ in this language that had a compiler of 1K. And it was a stack-based language. Obviously, it's very small, and it used single-character commands for most of its functionality. And then in reaction to that, there were two languages that were created also in 1993. Brainfuck is one of them, which was Urban Mueller saying, you made a compiler that's only 1K, I'm going to make one that's one quarter that size, and stripped out everything. So like False tries to have as much, like the features of False are very, very basic, but it's very fancy compared to Brainfuck, which gives you almost nothing at all to work with. So that's like the super minimalist version. And then also Bfunge by Chris Pressy, which is, it took the idea of the single character command from False and said, well, if you're going to have commands that are only one letter, why do we need to read it left to right? Why can't we have code move a little bit to the right and then turn up and then go off the page and come up off the bottom and so on? And so Pressy decided to create a language that would be the most difficult language to build a compiler for. I believe that was the original idea, by having it so that code can just turn in different directions, just flow across the space. And so now you start to have a little bit of, you know, you're having a conversation between people making languages, these experimental languages. And then over time, there were more and more languages added to that.
It sort of feels like this might have been loosely connected around the early days of the internet, especially in the academic space, I suppose, who had access to it earlier.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the three examples I gave, I think, were all for the Amiga. So I kind of think of it
as.
So, but I'm not sure how important that was. There were other languages that came out around that time.
But it's funny as you're saying that, because I was an Amiga person in the, maybe a couple of years after that, sort of mid-90s. And also the Amiga was famous for the kind of demo scene, this aspect of trying to get as much happening as possible on a floppy disk with graphics and music and things like that. I don't know. I don't know if it was really the platform, just the time, and it happened to be the platform at the time, maybe. And, you know, shareware and BBSs were popular. I used to go to, like, market stalls in those days, and you would just find people selling boxes of floppy disks with all sorts of all sorts of stuff. Yeah, sort of just a bit of a precursor to the internet for the common person.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of crossover between these things, because they involve this kind of artistry, but also a kind of technical wizardry that sort of, like, I mean, because part of the thing about demo is, like, look how much I can do with this really, like, minimal program, right? And especially with the sort of minimalist SLNs of the 90s, there's some of that thinking as well. Mm. But what really first interested me in SLN specifically is the way that it is something that's community-based. You know, if you make a language, it's an invitation for other people to use the language. Yeah. And what's really interesting is when you make a language and somebody else shows you what's possible to do with your language, or discovers something new about it that you couldn't really have foreseen on your own. I mean, the example of Brainfuck, I mean, Urban Mueller has not been really sort of involved in the SLN community very much, as far as I know, since the early days. And yet this has had such a legacy of so many people, you know, people writing web servers and Brainfuck, people doing all kinds of, you know, crazy complex experiments with it. And they're all sort of building on each other and taking this original vision much further than the original author could have foreseen.
Yeah. So let's fast forward a little bit and talk about your book that is coming out later this year, 44 Etherlangs. Could have gone for 42. Being anyway,
this is our cover. We finally have a cover design for it.
It's kind of what I imagined, even though I'd never seen it before. So just explain what it is. I have got about halfway through, and the structure is also different. So what is the book?
Yeah, it's definitely been an interesting experience explaining this book to people, because it does have a few very different audiences who come with different sort of understandings. In terms of how it's organized, right, because that was your first question, much of the book is made up of the section called prompts. Mm. And in prompts, I have short descriptions for esoteric languages that maybe I've implemented and maybe not. Maybe I leave it for the reader to implement. And my model for that was not so much previous technical writing or writing about code, but really I looked at the example of examples from two different artists. The book Grapefruit by Yoko Ono, which is a book of performance scores that people can perform or not. Mm. But much of the emphasis in that is the idea that you could read the description of a performance that is a performance that really lives in your mind. It's sort of like a short poetic piece that you can think about and maybe discover people performing without knowing it by accident or having a moment where that sort of recalls that piece. And then in the second half, I'm going a little bit more specifically for about half the languages, where I'm describing the realization of the language.
Yeah.
And the realization is not the same as the implementation. The realization is I take the wider concept and I more specifically bring it down to an idea that now is sort of really anchored in the specifics. And so I give a little bit of a description of what those specifics are, so people can really get a sense of what it would be like to use that language. And then for many of the languages, many of the languages are implemented, which I have up on my website.
So they're all yours, is the other question I was going to add to that. They're all your ideas, and some of which you've implemented. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. This is written as an artist monograph. Yeah. So it's a collection of my work in that space.
Actually, it's funny as well, because I would think you might be someone vaguely familiar with Kurt Vonnegut. And they remind me a lot of his like throwaway Kilgore Trout novels, where he'll just like throw in this idea for a Kilgore Trout novel, which doesn't exist. And you're kind of like, I really want to read that. I can't remember any off the top of my head, but some of them are wonderful. Like, I'll read a couple of my favorite ones without giving too much of the book away. Language 6, a rhetorical programming language where the interpreter only runs code it itself writes when convinced of its necessity. What else we got?
So that's one that I did not make. I really hope that he makes it, because I think that would be really fun.
a programming language where all numbers are approximate, written as around half or slightly more than 50, which, I mean, that actually sounds vaguely implementable in some respects, I suppose.
It's implementable. It's just that, like, the thing is that once, if you were going to implement this language, right, it would have repercussions in terms of, like, who would this language be for and how are they using it? It's one that definitely seems sort of AI related, because it's sort of like the vague way that we describe things to AI. And we hope that good code is going to come out
of it. Vibe coding is the.
I haven't actually implemented that. I came close with, there's one of the languages in there. I don't know which number it is, but it's the one that I named Memo. An idea of Memo is it's sort of like a running session that you might sort of carry with you through the day. And you can keep adding it, so it's one program and you keep adding code to it, but it only keeps 12 lines of code on the screen. And as things roll off.
Yes. Because this reminded me of, so I'm mostly a writer, and there's a couple of text editors that do this, that kind of force you to keep going. Otherwise you lose everything.
That's
another language. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
This one is sort of the opposite. It's sort of like, so if I write a 13th line of code, the first line of code scrolls off, and whatever the current state is of everything else that might've been using that one line of code is sort of locked into that now. The way it ties into the other language is that, first of all, you're writing it all in natural language for this. Mm. There's no parentheses. You have to use and if you want to connect things. And so if you have a whole bunch of things together, like, you know, remember X as Y plus 15, you know, minus 3 or whatever, like you start to run into a place where writing it out in natural language without parentheses, like the word and, you don't know which clause it's connecting to. And you're sort of just trusting that the interpreter will come up with something that's sort of reasonable. And you're just going to have to sort of live with that. Yeah. And of course, you can correct it, but you can't be too picky, because each time you sort of rewrite that line of code, something else is scrolling off the screen that you're losing. And now your program becomes something else. So it's almost sort of like a sort of drifting consciousness of like, here's my program as it is now. It's going to look completely different a few hours from now as I keep writing. But some elements will sort of remain based on what had been there before. Mm. But a lot of it is sort of getting away from the sort of perfectionism of code, the idea that we're going to write code that's going to run the way that we want, or that we really have that much control
over. It's funny you say that, because the one I currently have highlighted, though, is the absolute personification of perfection, and actually veers into almost territory of like extreme programming. Number 14, a programming language that refuses error. Should a bug be discovered, its creator is banned from the language. I mean, this could be useful in some respects.
It could be useful to someone. It's not going to be useful to me, but yeah, there's, you know, but there's a lot of languages here that I think push back a little bit on that not just the perfectionism and the sort of computational, I guess, idealism behind much of coding, but the idea that we are logical beings that can really understand the logic of such complexity and really maintain control over it.
This is actually, I think it's in your preface, I think. It's one of my favorite opening lines. Our engagement with logic is irrational because we are irrational beings. We are incapable of fully asserting our agency through a series of logical steps. This central drama of human-computer interaction is experienced most directly at code level. I think that kind of sums up things very, very well.
Yeah, that's as close as I have to a kind of a thesis statement.
And of course, you start your thesis in point zero, like a good programmer should, not at point one. So a question that was in the back of my mind through a lot of this is, you mentioned a lot of these are kind of more artistic, creative endeavors, but have any of these esoteric languages actually made it into out of that kind of scene into something actually more widely used in production? Or not really?
Well, I certainly no one's told me that like they have put into production code using like, say, my folders language, which is the language where all code is a pattern of folders within folders. I mean, I would love it if someone had, if there's some financial system that was actually running on folders. But it's not like, when I'm creating languages that make it more difficult to understand exactly what's going to happen when the code runs, which a lot of these languages do, it definitely makes it less likely that people are going to use it in that way, especially because nobody is sort of writing great optimizers for these and treating it as like a world-class language in that way.
JetBrains aren't making an IDE. But even in some of the older ones, like none of them have ever, some of them are more legendary than others, but they haven't kind of made it into a wider, I don't know, for some reason, it clicked with a particular use case that somehow made sense.
Yeah, I think that the use cases that they click with are not ones that are about making really reliable code.
No, I just wondered. You never know. Sometimes these things can surprise you, but
they often do. And often, you know, that's really what's exciting about doing this. It are those surprises. So Otto, which is my language zero, it's actually also the last language because I sort of did a new recent version of it, which I'm excited to put live soon. It's a language that's written in music.
This one appealed to me a lot because I'm also a musician and I have been experimenting a lot with like music XML and MIDI, of course. There's these digital representations of music for some time. And there is a lot of correlation with code and music. So flip it on its head is kind of interesting.
it's the opposite of computer-generated music. Yeah. It's very considered music written by a human being who just has to do it within these constraints that might seem sort of arbitrary, but can bring somebody to an interesting place. So there's one composer who's written.
Yeah, this would be fascinating because you could complete the loop, couldn't you? You could actually have the language that is music, and then the music is played, and keep it sort of.
Yeah, I would love that. Actually, there's this Spanish composer who wrote sort of a pseudo quine for it. It's not really a quine, but it is a Volato program that generates code that creates another Volato program that then prints the word quine. So it doesn't quite loop back to itself, but that's the closest that someone has come yet for it. There is a project by Endo. He's a programmer who I think helped develop Ruby, I believe, who created a quine with something like 128 different languages. So like language A produces code in language B, which produces code in C, and it ends up back at the beginning at language A again. So it's circular. It's an Ouroboros quine. That's how he describes it. And that actually has Volato as one of the languages. And what's interesting is that he very strictly did everything in alphabetical order from language to language.
So Volato is towards the end then. So yeah.
It's at the end. Yeah. Well, no, I think he starts and ends with Ruby.
Oh, okay. Okay.
but it's so it is part of a quine, a larger quine, but it hasn't yet reached that state. But I want to answer the other thing that you were saying about people finding their own use for it or for these languages. One of the other languages that I have in the book, it's a dialect of JavaScript called Fatfinger. Mm-hmm. And the idea of Fatfinger was that you can write JavaScript and you can write it fast and sloppy and hit the wrong keys. And basically what happens is it looks for the closest thing in scope in terms of the Levenstein distance, like the distance and number of keystrokes. And so it sort of just replaces one word with the other. And it says, oh, this is the JavaScript that you were trying to write. And it just run it that way. And the idea was instead of being a spell checker for JavaScript, it was meant to be, let's leave all the typos in and we'll just have typo written JavaScript, and that's just what it'll look like now. And in fact, the way that you invoke this is you include the library and then you open a script tag with a misspelling of JavaScript, and that sets it into the fat finger mode. So I had this very sort of specific vision for the way that this would work. And then there was a code poet who looked at this, someone coming to it from the digital humanities side, a professor at USC, Jeremy Douglas. And his approach was, instead of writing sloppy typo-written JavaScript, he would write code poetry, poetry that reads as poetry in English, but that it runs as a JavaScript program. And normally when people write code poetry, they're kind of stuck with the keywords of the language and they just make creative use of variables and comments and whatnot. But he started using Fatfinger as a way to replace the word navigator with the word daughter, or the word window with, you know, widow or something else. That's just something that he knew would translate back into that word. And it gave this larger freedom in terms of how things were worded in the code poetry. So that was a really interesting use. That was something that I had not anticipated.
Yeah. And I guess it starts to move into this whole, I think it's this whole like computational creativity space as well.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other area that I've kind of kept an eye on, but never gone massively deep into, even though I really want to. But this has been a fascinating conversation. I feel like I could have kept going. It's also getting quite late for me and the conversation is strange enough. So before my brain vanishes off into even stranger realms. So we mentioned the title of the book, 44 Isolangs.
Yes.
It's coming out in MIT Press, I think.
MIT Press, it's a publisher. It's coming out September 23rd.
September. And you also have langs.org is not your website, is it? That's a more general website.
Yeah. SLX.org is really wonderful and people should definitely spend a lot of time there. Just kind of my site is esoteric.codes, which is where I interviewed many other SLangers about their work.
I think that could be a good place to go to after listening to this, if this is new to people. And I would imagine it's new to a lot of people. And out of interest, so the ones you have implemented, like how runnable are they? Like, are they cross-platform? Are they in the browser? Like, how can people actually try them?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's something that I've really kind of changed my attitude about over the years. Like, early on, I was like, oh, I have to write like a serious compiler for my language. And later, I was like, you know, what's really important is that people across different platforms and different spaces can use it. So in general, I try to write everything in JavaScript when I can and have it run in the browser. If I don't, then I tend to stick with Python because it seems to have the largest user base. I get a little bored of those two languages, so sometimes I strike out this into other territory, but that's usually my priority.
There's a certain irony there, isn't there? It's implement that you have to use two languages you're bored with, but the output's interesting, I suppose. So yeah. Just to clarify this again, so your website is ISO...
Oh, yeah. So I have two websites.
Okay.
My website is danieltumpkin.com.
Okay.
And that's where you can actually find implementations of these languages, which will continue to grow. My other site is esoteric.codes. And that is where I have interviews and short pieces about SLangs. And in general, it's written for a less technical audience. It's meant to be understandable to people who are not deep in the programming language world.
Yeah, amazing. And yeah, MIT Press, some point in September, I did have the privilege of visiting there late October 2023, and my nerd joy was tickled by visiting MIT. So yeah. I don't really know how to end this interview because it's just so different from the ones I normally do. But I was so looking forward to speaking to you. When I was leaving the game earlier, I was just like, I've got to talk to a guy about strange programming languages. Everyone looked at me like, what? But I know this stuff fascinates me. So, yeah.
Is this something that we should pick up again at some point? Or do you feel like you have enough?
No, we'll see between us. But I think people, I think, you know, the prefaces of the book and your kind of attitude around this are right. You know, so much of computing now and has become kind of so overly professional and over monetized and over commercialized that just sometimes encountering just pure joy for no particular reason is something I think we should do more. So Thank you very much for pursuing these experiments.
There's one thing I guess I would like to say in terms of what we were talking about in terms of AI, natural language, and so on. You know, there's more of a sense that it's not just that managers want to replace programmers with, I don't know, vibe coders or like, this has been sort of what many people in the industry have wanted to do since the 60s is make programming easier so that managers and business folks, and I don't know what the right term is, so that you know, since the 60s, there's been an attempt to make code easier to write so that business analysts can write code without programmers.
Yeah.
This goes back to the beginning of you know, it goes back to like Flowmatic and these languages from the 60s. And of course, we remember the first few versions of Visual Basic and the idea that this was going to take over code and programmers would no longer be needed. And I feel like the latest version of this is AI. The idea that,
yeah, it's a good point.
You know, AI not only is like, I mean, I think it's great to get more people involved in programming and making it more expansive. But the idea of AI is that, number one, it kind of turns coding into a subscription service where you have these tools in order to even sort of do your basic work. But it also, it tends to really sort of narrow the type of code that we're writing and the way that we think about code. And I think that SLangs are a great alternative to this. And number one, it can be seen as a form of resistance against AI. You can create languages that AI does not yet sort of understand. But more importantly, it shows people that they can make their own languages. You don't have to be this somebody who has a degree in computer science. It's not as difficult as it sounds. And with an SLang, it can be something that you can put together sometimes in an afternoon if your idea is simple enough. And of course, in this book with the prompts, I have many sort of SLangs that sort of exist as languages because they're described and defined, but they don't have any sort of specifics and they're not actually implemented. Yeah. But the idea is sort of what's really important.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's something that I really hope people walk away with from the book, both that they themselves can make their own languages and that the concept is more important than the technical mastery in the languages or the code.
I think that's a wonderful place to stop. So, Daniel, it's been a great conversation. Thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, thank you so much.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.